Graham is committed to strict compliance with the antitrust laws and its obligations under a settlement agreement with the FTC. To this end, NAM has put in place an antitrust policy governing all activity during NAM-sponsored events. NAM's antitrust policy covers all participants, including speakers, exhibitors, and audience members at NAM events. The antitrust laws prohibit certain conduct, including agreements between or among competitors on price or output, agreements between or among competitors to divide markets or allocate customers, territories, products, or services, and boycotts or refusals to deal with any suppliers, customers, or competitors. It is important to remember that all of these activities are prohibited regardless of intent. Additionally, it is not necessary to have an explicit agreement to violate the antitrust laws. Circumstantial evidence can suffice. Remember, all NAM members must make competitive decisions independently of any agreement or understanding with competitors. NAM show participants must not exchange competitively sensitive information, including information regarding wholesale and retail prices, discounts, credit terms, margins or profits, proposed price increases or decreases, price ranges, price formulas, MAP policies, and RPM policies. Of course, these prohibitions do not apply to legitimate business discussions between manufacturers and retailers. NAM and its members could be subject to fines and other serious consequences for failure to comply with NAM's obligations under the antitrust laws. Anyone that violates NAM's antitrust policy may be subject to discipline, including removal from this event and possible expulsion from the organization. This reminder is not a complete list of activities that could raise antitrust concerns. NAM's full antitrust policy can be found on NAM's website. Specific details regarding NAM's obligations under the FTC order are also available on NAM's website. Just click on the Antitrust Compliance tab on NAM's homepage. Please direct questions on antitrust compliance to NAM's Antitrust Compliance Officer, Paul Cuomo, of Baker Botts LLP, or to your company's legal counsel. If you have any questions about antitrust compliance, you should seek legal advice before acting. Thank you for your attention and cooperation with this very important matter.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to NAM IP Forum. Creators, innovators, fabricators. It's really nice that you took a break from the trade show floor to come and join us. Don't hesitate during our time together to grab a beverage or a cupcake that's left over from our music education celebration at noon today. So happy to share those with you. My name is Mary Larson. I'm Director of Public Affairs and Government Relations for NAM. I do a lot of the government relations work on behalf of all of NAM members, spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C., lobbying and advocating, and as I say, please don't hold that against me. Washington, you know, usually that goes over a little better than it just did. Must be late in the day. Keep eating those cupcakes.
Yeah.
We're really pleased to have with us Melody, come around this way, there's the stairs, a panel of folks who are your peers, also NAM members, who were with us for NAM's IP Academy on May 9th in Alexandria, Virginia, at the headquarters of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And before we hear from them and go through a series of questions, just a little bit of background on the NAM IP Forum, which I think we finally hit on the right name. We are going to call it ourselves the Forum, IP Forum, Creators, Innovators, Fabricators, and the Music Products Industry. We'll have periodic meetings probably at Winter NAM again and at Summer NAM. It's kind of organic and based on your needs and your desires. And this actually got started about 3 years ago, 2 years ago, when the infamous PIPA and SOPA bills were moving through the U.S. Congress. And it was actually, we thought that there was some pretty good momentum around intellectual property laws that were coming down through the House and the Senate. And it was actually the Wednesday of that NAM show, I think it was 2 years ago, that Google and Wikipedia shut down for 24 hours in opposition to those bills, and the bills were pulled. Does anyone remember that? I mean, that's, you know, kind of the power of the internet and the global community that, and we were very involved in the weeks and months leading up to that with a coalition to advance some of the changes that were represented in those bills. So since then, we've been loosely together as a group of NAM members, but always anchored around a spring event, which we want to tell you more about, which is a on-site training at the offices of U.S. Patent and Trademark offices in Alexandria, Virginia, called the NAM IP Academy. So we first want to give you a little background from our NAM members here on what that experience was and was like and what they learned. And I think it's important, just as a little asterisk, we don't want to, the IP Academy and the education and advocacy available to NAM members through the IP Forum is not meant or intended in any way to replace any of the legal support that you need in your business for intellectual property. I think that's just a disclaimer that, you know, we need to make. What we hope to do is to provide education, some best practices, some peer-to-peer sharing that maybe will help you engage those professionals in the most productive and effective way. And I think that's been some of the learning that has occurred in just a few months that you hear from some of the NAM members. So it's this very important caveat that we don't enter into that legal advice zone relative to the serious and responsible work of protecting your patent, protecting your trademark. You need to leave that to the experts. We need to know you're consulting with the experts. But the information that you can gather with and through this forum may make you a more proactive and informed user of those services. So I'd like to join our panel, and just what we'll do first is we'll go down the panel, have each of you introduce yourself, your name, your title, your company, a little bit about your company, and then we'll jump in. No social security number needed, or EIN, all those.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rolf Sechter. I'm the president of New Business Development for VTech Corporation. We are famous for our cordless phones and also for the electronic learning products, but I'm heading up the division for contract manufacturing, which is a very sensitive IP issue with contract manufacturers, because we get from customers confidential material and we have to monitor this IP. I'll go into this a little bit later. I hold a master's degree in RF electronics from quite some years ago, where germanium transistors had glass and black paint on it, and when you took it off, it became a photodiode. So I grew up with triodes and pentodes. I'm also a radio amateur operator, so I still love radio tubes and transmit tubes. And I'm also a patent agent with the USPTO. I don't know whether you know the role of a patent agent. It's similar to a patent lawyer, but I cannot do litigation and I cannot do trademark. But the patent lawyer has to take the same test with the USPTO.
Thanks, Rob.
Oh, you've got one.
I'm Melanie Dyer, and I am one of the founders of Coopercopia and the Cooperstand products. We've been in business for about 4 years. My background is colorful, as is Daniel, my partner. I have been a flight attendant for 25 years with a major airline. I've been a publisher of music. I've had cuts by artists such as Tom Rush. I met my partner, Daniel, and we started a business about 4 years ago, and it's been booming. We're happy.
Everyone in business with someone else, somebody has to take the position of the voice of reason. So this person over here is that person. My name's Daniel Cooper. I'm the CEO of Coopercopia LLC. And we founded our company about, in 2010, January, with the first Cooperstand product, a guitar stand that folds up and fits inside the case of a guitar. And it's gone pretty crazy. It's kept us really busy. I come from a background of a singer-songwriter, musician, and a sculptural artist. I also came from a family of tool and die makers and engineers of this type of hands-on stuff. And I was able to find another access to the music business by putting down the guitar for a little while and making a product that works. And we've been just going gangbusters with it and just trying to learn the business as we go along.
Thank you. All right, I'm John Chandler, founder and president of ProStage Gear, based right here in Franklin, Tennessee. And I hate talking about myself, so I'm gonna make it really fast. We have a line of effects pedal boards. The booming pedal business has been a really great thing for me because we are making all kinds of accessories and things to go with those pedal junkies, those addicts, I call them. And so we have a patent, a really strong patent. We have some intellectual property and some trademark names. And when I heard about this opportunity, I thought I need to go check it out. I was available free, and you couldn't beat the price free. It blew my mind, just what they can cram into one day. I don't know, maybe I shouldn't talk about that yet, but that's it.
Okay, so you're part of the energy of the pedal boom. We can point to that part of the table.
Oh,
that's,
yeah.
That's great. That's great. You know, I guess this all represents kind of a dream come true when you think about an arc of a life. You know, the fact that you can actually invent something or perfect something or fabricate something, and then you actually see it grow legs and go out and it brings back and you can pay for your kids' preschools and things start happening like that. And then I guess the nightmare in that dream is when all of a sudden you see that product on a shelf in another country with your brand and all those resources are going to another entity. So the reason that we developed over time a very close relationship with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office that has for years had a booth in the lobby at the Anaheim show. And they, you know, as good regulators, they are federal employees, and they have taken a real shine to the music products industry. Very interesting to develop personal relationships with people that love coming to your show, not surprising, everybody loves to come to the show, that are now kind of the fabric of that NAMM show family. So when a year ago they said, we really need to invite your members to come to our headquarters where we have these resources of all these people and all these experts, and we would put together a training just for NAMM members. So we did it a year ago in 12, and then we've just repeated it in 13, and this is the class of 13. And our first question, and we're going to drill down to a couple of other questions about best practices in IP and intellectual property trademarks, so we'll get to some of the nitty-gritty. But I wanted to just talk first about the IP Academy that we had on May 9th, and just go down the panel and say, what were your key takeaways for that IP Academy, and what resources have you or are you considering to use or to change some parts that you picked up at the IP Academy? So again, this is kind of an advertisement for next spring. When it comes around again, we really want anyone interested to consider signing up. So let's just keep going in the same order, and then we'll mix it up later. So John won't always be last. Ralph, give us your key takeaways.
Okay, well, it was like coming home because the building in Alexandria, the patent office building, is a very nice-looking building. And we had a good meeting there, and I met some of the lawyers, some of the patent attorneys, and so on at the USPTO. And the major takeaway was the copyright, which I never studied as a patent agent, because I cannot do trademark, I cannot do copyright, I can only advise on copyright. But this was a major, major thing that whenever you design a document or write a document, the copyright remains with the originator of the document, even though if you are a contractor and you're being paid by your client to write something like a technical spec or design something, the design remains unless you waive it and then you give it back to the client. We do it as VTech in contract manufacturing. We are very famous for the music industry, and Harman is our flagship account, and all these divisions like Crown and the JBL people. And they come to us sometimes and say, VTech, can you design it? And we pass it back to the client. So when they pay us, they own the intellectual property and the design. That was my major takeaway. I didn't know that before.
Well, I want to say if you ever get a chance to come to the Global Intellectual Property Seminar, it's very informative. You get to be one-on-one with patent and trademark attorneys. And even during lunch, and they're joking, you can ask questions. So it's a very good opportunity that you should take advantage of. Of course, the city is great. We spent one day going to two of the 17 Smithsonians, so it's, make it a vacation and come. We started our company 4 years ago and had a lot of questions at that time. We did quite a bit of individual research, but there were still other things that came up at the seminar that were pertinent to our business. And we came home and had other questions for our own patent and trademark attorneys that we hadn't addressed. And there were things that we learned, such as if you have a trademark, it's probably a good idea to register it with customs, and just things that I didn't know.
Voice of Reasons know a lot. I think I was really impressed with the fact that you could ask questions that most people who think, well, I've got this great idea and I want to do something with it, and assume that they can, oh, save money or whatever and do it themselves or cut out, you know, cut the corners. And the importance of getting information, it's hard to put a price on it, but in this particular venue, you can get the answers from the people who end up looking over what you're trying to do. So it's firsthand. And for the money invested, which is getting there and staying there for a couple of days, you know, you're looking at $3,000 or $4,000 worth of free advice. And I don't see how you can go wrong with that. So if you have something that means something to you, doing something at the end of the process, getting advice from those people, is priceless. That's what I brought home.
That's interesting. So in other words, you're preparing their forms, their materials, the way they want it, and you have the opportunity in the process to meet with those folks who are exactly writing the rules, basically.
Right.
John, how about you?
There were so many takeaways, and I'm still processing just the data. I just felt like it was data overload. I can't believe that much could be crammed into one day. And I came home with a stack of things to read and web links. There is so much out there, information free, available on the U.S. Patent and Trademark website. Other sites that they tell you about that you didn't know about. I was really excited to see that there are some people at the Patent and Trademark Office in Washington that actually care about what they're doing. So much so that they take the time to say, look, we are not your enemy. You know, we're here to help you. We're here to help you protect your intellectual property. Just the business cards that I have in my wallet now as a result of attending that thing were the connections with those people. And I think they're genuine when they say, hey, you have a question, shoot me an email. You want some help with something, I can tell you where to go to get some help. That was really invaluable. The people, the information. And I think the thing is, the main takeaway for me was you cannot, in this global climate, this global economy, global market, pretend like it's not going to happen to you. Pretend like, you know, I can just stick my head in the sand. If you're a small company or if you're a big company, it really doesn't matter. You need to take it seriously. Don't get freaked out and overwhelmed and scared, but just find the right people to connect with and say, look, I think that I have something that I might want to make a career out of. I want to make sure that 10 years down the road, I don't see my exact trademarked logo or brand name or product in somewhere. It's one thing if they're going to copy your product and name it something else. When they copy it and name it exactly the same thing that you did, that's frightening. And to find out how easily people are doing that and can do that, but with a little bit of planning and preparation and patience, you can stop it from happening.
You know, we also got close to the machine when you're in that building. And although we didn't have a specific topic on it, that there is, over the years, we have met with there's a division of Homeland Security. Now, I know we all have varying opinions about the value of all these federal agencies, but we won't go into that here, right? But there's a division of Homeland Security that deals specifically with counterfeit product, because they really feel that counterfeiting undermines the U.S. economy and undermines U.S. security. So, you know, to sit in a building that is, you know, focused on it, earning fees from it. We know that to get a patent, to have a trademark, there's fees. That building is paid for by fees, not by taxpayers. But it's very interesting to be in that environment and to hear directly from them how seriously they take what is being done by every one of you that is creating, innovating, or fabricating. And that they you know, there are layers that, again, we didn't touch at IP Academy that are really out there working for us on the enforcement side. And you can see this most visibly, or we hear about this most visibly, relative to pharmaceuticals. This is a place where the U.S. patent enforcement and the counterfeiting enforcement has been the most severe, because it can really impact, you know, the health of our citizens and the trade, and not only the manufacturing. So that's kind of the, you know, the orbit that we got to brush up against. And the other thing I think for me is that they are also, they not only are armed with an enormous amount of technical knowledge, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it was reams and reams of PowerPoints and web links, but they're also pretty savvy that they have to communicate this like real people. So they have on their sites what they call the wizards format. You can go in and do a wizard, and they kind of walk you through a step, and I think all kind of demystified the process, because they want to promote American innovation. I mean, they are really the infrastructure to want to promote and protect it. So thank you for that and for a quick takeaway. Now let's go to our next question. What effective, maybe new solutions or revised solutions for IP protections are you currently implementing? And this is where you're going to share a little bit of your own, you know, kind of business practices with the group in terms of what is maybe something that you've made a recent change about that is really for you a new best practice for IP. And Ralph, we know you have probably the most complicated business structure up here as a contract manufacturer. So give us in simple wizard terms.
Yeah. I would like to come back to what John had said. It might happen to you, and what Mary just said about, you know, the counterfeit and so on. I saw about a month ago a website. Because we do manufacture a lot of products, wireless and what have you, microphones like these. And so I downloaded the website, and they have an email address. It's a company in China. And I said, can you send me the price list? They say, yeah, you can have the price list, no problem at all. It is called the Professional, let me put on my second pair of eyes here, Professional Audio Equipment Factory. And what you can see here is the logos, JBL, DBX, Shure, PV, Ashley, BMB, Yamaha, you know, all those logos. So it suggests they sell that equipment, right? Not so at all. The first sentence reads, they are one-to-one manufactured in accordance with the original. Interesting, right? So these are all wireless microphones. This is just one page, but they also build speaker systems, amplifiers, well, what have you, and so on. So we are also a Chinese company. Our headquarters in Hong Kong. VTech is well known, as I mentioned, and we have about 30,000 people. The contract manufacturing arm is about 4,500 people manufacturing in China. But to answer the question here, what did we implement? We have been in business for 23 years as a Chinese company with manufacturing in China, and we built a lot of pro audio products, medical products, telecom products, and so on. And all our people are trained. I personally wrote the website for our intellectual property protection, And we train our people. For instance, in VTEC, nobody has, everybody has a laptop, almost everybody, but the laptops have no USB port. So you cannot download from the laptop to your own personal use any drawings or specifications. We usually write an NDA with our customers and potential customers. People have only access on an as-needed basis, and we constantly monitor what's going on in the factory, and we have had zero incidents over the 23 years that a CEO wrote a letter and said, guess what, VTEC, I saw my product half a year later in Shanghai on the market as a knockoff. We have not any incident in our factory, and when people leave, they're being asked to leave all the documentation and so on. Obviously, the knowledge you have in your brain, you cannot unload that one, but we, as I said, people are honest, and we train them well, and when they leave, there's no problem in any violation of intellectual property rights.
Melanie and Dan, how about you?
Well, we came home and talked about one of the things that I think the trademark attorney talked about, making sure that you get your trademark into a country known for counterfeiting before you enter that area, even before you think about getting in there, and make sure that you're covered. And so that's something that we've come home and talked to our trademark attorney about.
Yeah, kind of an offshoot of that is I've noticed that a lot of our dealers and both domestic and international, our trademark is one word, Cooper Stand. And it's just assumed that it's Cooper Stands. And we see this published everywhere. So we've tried to really focus on making those people aware in the best way possible without insulting them that they're using the incorrect name, so that they are using the right name for our brand.
To
be aware that, of course, China is always the country that does come up, but there are plenty of other countries out there that are active in this kind of activity too. So you have to kind of be aware of that and be prepared in advance by having your trademark covered.
Yeah, some of what I was saying was probably accidental. It's just, have you used the Cooper Stands? Well, you know, that creates a mindset. And you kind of have to go back and educate people and make sure that you're out there as who you are.
It's like, also, I think we heard that you have to, you know, there's great excitement when a product starts to take off. It's like, oh, we just sold a shipload of Cooper Stand to Germany, mm-hmm. right? And you're going to, do we have a trademark in Germany? Have we locked down our trademark in Germany? Mm-hmm. So in this part, it's that check on have you covered all the bases is before, because things can take off, you know, if you all of a sudden it becomes that, you know, the luck of that experience, and have you really made it as part of business planning? I think it, not to put the brakes on, but to put the eyeglasses mm-hmm. on and make sure you're
right.
John, how about you? Kind of things, best practice you're implementing?
Well, you know, that meeting at the IP Academy was on a Thursday, I think.
Yeah, it was.
I flew home on Friday, and on Monday morning, I called my patent attorney and intellectual property attorney. I let him have it, you know.
Oh.
I let him have it, and I'm sure he's thinking, oh my God, now he's armed with knowledge, and he's going to beat me with it. But I really, you know, I had a lot of questions for him, and he, you know, he said, well, sure, we can do this and we can do that, and you never asked me to look into this or to look into that. And he's happy to just take my money and do what I ask him to do, but sometimes we've got to ask them, you know, the right questions. And so we started, you know, at that moment, I said, look, I want you to give me a game plan. Here's the countries where we sell into now. Here's the countries where we don't have any trademark registered, any brand registered, anything.
Any coverage.
Any coverage at
right,
all.
Right, coverage.
So it's wide open. Let's start tomorrow to get these in place. Mm-hmm. One of the things, and you know, I have to admit, I have a distributor, a small distributor in China. I'm manufacturing, my products are made in China. The pedal market is not really huge in China. We need some more guitar players in China for that to be huge.
Yeah, it's not yet.
So I had let my Chinese distributor register my trademark. I consented to that in a, just a conversation. He asked me several years ago, hey, can I register your trademark? Because I want to protect my interest as your distributor, but I want to protect your interest, you know, because I'm not going to be able to be successful unless we have this trademark, you know, logo and trademark name secured. So I said, sure, go ahead. And then I heard here what at the IP Academy, don't ever, ever let someone else register your trademark in another country. Because you don't know that they're going to have your best interest. They might have for a while. They might think, hey, you know what? We did really good with this. Let's go get a manufacturer and let's start our own. And so I quickly sent an email and called the guy. He said, no, I'm serious. And we began to make a transition where he has now transferred ownership of that trademark over to me, which he said was his intention from the beginning. I dodged a bullet there, and I'm very grateful you know, to have known that. But there's not so many, you know, there's a lot of stories that won't end like mine did in that regard for China in particular.
Ralph, what's
it? Yeah, I just want to add something to what has been said. It does not only apply to trademark, it also applies to patent, everything which was said. So I highly recommend if you have an idea, don't talk to anyone about it. Keep it yourself. Don't sell the product within 12 months. If the USPTO finds out that you have sold samples to someone and you took money, or even you gave it to people, after 12 months, you cannot register your product with a patent anymore because it's known prior art, so to speak. And therefore, if you have an idea, when you talk to someone, sign an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. It might be us as VTech, as a contract manufacturer, or an individual who might be an venture capitalist and so on. So when you have an idea and file a so-called PCT application, which is PCT stands for Paris Corporation Treaty, and that's a patent worldwide. And then you can decide after 30 months whether you file the patent in China and Germany and in the UK and wherever you want to do business.
All right. I don't know if I should give you a break and tell my Greece story.
Go ahead.
Should I tell my Greece story? This is a story that came out of the first class of IP Academy. We had a wonderful gentleman with us who's a NAMM member who has actually made his living as a remarkable arranger and was on the forefront of the CD karaoke's and actually, you know, doing background arrangements and that an entire school chorus or a whole show could be produced with these background CDs. And he had secured the licensing for the musical Grease, right? We all know that great. Is it 50s, 60s, 60s? Right, well, John Travolta did it, right? And it was on Broadway, of course. Well, he had the musical rights to do the karaoke arrangements and sell them, and he was doing very well selling them to middle schools and high schools who would, you know, they put on the CD, the kids would do the song and dance, the parents would all pay $7 and have bake sales and everyone would be happy, right? He was doing very, very well with that, kind of as a one-man show competing against the Hal Leonards and the Alfreds, you know, it was one of those. He just had a little niche that was really working for him. And for 10 years of this project, he'd been getting a letter every quarter from a legal entity saying, please send me your report on the distribution of Grease production or your Grease packs because I own the trademark for Grease. So he would do his reconciliation of how many he sold that quarter. The guy owned the trademark. He said, you owe me this much money. He'd write him a check and send him the money. Well, at the 10 years, every quarter, at the IP Academy, This gentleman, part of our trademark conversation was that a function can never be trademarked. You grease a car, you grease a wheel, you grease a squeaky door, you put grease on a pan. The word grease cannot be trademarked. Now, the product of the musical could be copyrighted, but the trademark was not existent. They actually put up the USPTO database and we do search grease and it's not applicable. This gentleman turned purple in the room. He left the room. And I've seen him and I've asked him if he's had resolution. He kind of doesn't want to talk about it. But this is an example of the not the right knowledge at the right time. That for this amount of time, he had been essentially defrauded by someone who tried it once, it worked, and kept going every quarter. Very, very sad story, but an example of how a little bit of knowledge can really really save the game.
Yeah.
Luckily,
can I add something there on that,
yes,
on
please,
that regard?
Please.
There was something brought up that we did discuss quite a bit. I think you guys even brought a copy of an example. If you have any, you probably know this already, but I think we should say it just in case. If you have any trademarks, copyrights, things like words or logos, you'll get periodically from non-civil entities, you need to pay this amount for, your registration of your patent trademark is due. You got to, sign here $1,400 or $800 or whatever, and it has $2,500 has nothing to do with it at all. It's if you have a good attorney who's monitoring, they're paying those renewal fees. They're making sure that all your T's are crossed and I's are dotted.
It's late in the day.
Anyway, so really, really scrutinize anything. I don't pay any bill that comes across my desk unless, you're going to have to prove to me I owe you this money, especially right. When it comes to intellectual property, because there are a lot of scams out there.
They use names that are so official sounding that you think it came from that particular organization.
Yeah.
And on official letterhead and all sorts of other official language and whatnot. It's like the... the lifetime car warranty statement I keep getting over and over and over for the car I don't even own anymore. Anyway, let's before we were going to have a Q&A, so start thinking a little bit ahead, but a great question to ask these peer experts here who've been in this business and scratched a lot of heads and paid a lot of fees to patent lawyers and attorneys. What IP mistakes did you wish you could have avoided if you could go back and fix? And what lessons can and should be learned sooner rather than later? Anyone want to start? Let's start in the middle. Melanie and Dan, let's start with you. You have the newest business, and I have to say they got a little of a blue ribbon recognition at IP Academy for doing a lot of things right early in the game. Not coming to a NAMM show to exhibit until they had their first provisional patent papers. They got a few kudos, so maybe sooner than wish you'd known sooner.
I had a background, in doing copyright administration. I felt like I knew a little bit about intellectual property. I certainly valued it, so it was really important to me to get intellectual property covered from the very beginning. Coming from that background, although a copyright is very different than a patent and a trademark, because it's a registration of a copyright, a patent is much more expensive and much more extensive and trickier, and only I think 3% of patents ever go to the market. But having had some knowledge, I thought that I could sit at my computer and do a trademark registration and not get flustered. And we were trying to do it like a lot of people do. It's like, well, save a little money and I'll start this. I got so flustered with it. And I just says, you know what? And he said the same thing too. We're calling a trademark attorney. It's taken too much of my time. I've got other things to do. So sometimes, even though you have experience, it's not enough experience. And sometimes if it's taken too much of your business time, there's nothing wrong with delegating. If you want something done right, hire a professional. My dad was a plumber, and I've done do-it-yourself projects. And if you need a plumber,
call a plumber. Yeah, you know, I think mistakes, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to look back and go, hey, I wish I'd have done that. I don't think you're going to be able to do it unless you've got deep, deep, deep pockets and somebody to do all the thinking for you. You're going to make mistakes. But a very wise man who's pretty successful, and I probably shouldn't say his name, so I won't, but he's on the floor. I asked him in an email, what do we do here? We've got options, these options, these options. Do we do a patent here, a patent there, a patent there? He says, go ahead and file and do what you can afford and pick the places that make most sense, because you can't do it all. You can't get a patent in every country unless you're filthy rich. Pick the ones that matter and try to protect everything you can. But one thing I will say, if you have an idea you think is good, don't hesitate. We were standing at this is the story, the Cooper Stand story. We were standing at a place called Douglas Corner here in Nashville. We live here. And we were playing one night, and I had a bag of guitar stands in one hand and a guitar in the other hand. It's pouring down rain, and the door is right on the sidewalk. So here I am trying to figure out, what do I sit down, my $4,000 Taylor or a bag full of stands that's going to get all wet and soggy? And I thought, you know, somebody needs to invent a guitar stand that fits in the case. I didn't sleep for weeks. You know, I was drawings in the middle of the night, and 25 prototypes later, we've sold, I don't know, 75,000 stands in the last 3.5 years. And it's like, wow. We're not rich, but we're paying the patents out, you know? You know, but there's a future. There's a light at the end of the tunnel that tells me, wow, we made the right choice. So if you believe in it, you believe in yourself, believe you're going to make mistakes, count on it. Don't look back and say, oh, I wish I'd done this. Just do what you can do.
Great advice. John, how about you? What do you wish you knew now that
that it was going to cost so much? But, you know, I mean, for me, I'm passionate about what I do. When the passion runs out, I'll be looking to sell it for sure. I guess that's the thing that, you know, if you have an idea, you know, or a design or a concept or whatever, and people, not just yourself, but other people think it's a great idea, and you launch it, that's awesome. But also along the way, a lot of people, other people are going to, who aren't so, you know, friendly, are going to say, well, that's a great idea. I'm going to take that. I'm going to run with that. They might be bigger than you. They might have deeper pockets than you. And it would be a sad thing to see, you know, someday a really successful product that you really were the first one to come up with, but you didn't do anything to protect it. You can't afford not to, really. The only way I learn anything is by making mistakes. I can tell you 50 ways to do it wrong the first time. So I'm really, you know, after still being in business for 13 years, that's a testament in itself. I'm a college dropout, ex-musician, like most people in that room over there or upstairs, who couldn't make it as a player. So we're like, let's go into the music products business, you know. I'll still get to play guitar, but I don't even get to play guitar. I have to look at spreadsheets, and I have to consider intellectual property and things like that now. But I wouldn't trade it for anything. I just say there are people all around. You just have to find them to help you through each step of the process. Some of them you're going to have to pay, and some of them you're going to, if you're friendly, you're going to get a lot of really great free advice from.
Can I add something to that?
Please, Dan, please.
When we first brought our product to NAMM and walked around and, you know, just to get feedback from people, you get every opinion. You'll get one guy that says, you know, you're not going to get rich on this. And you get this other guy over here that says, can I have that? And the next thing you know, you get an order for 500 of them. And that happens, and there's that whole spectrum in between. So just count on what you believe in. Mm-hmm. Because if you really believe in it, chances are it's going to work. And one more quick thing. One good product that succeeds will lead to another one. It'll just spark a new idea. And you realize the old saying, if you can make $1 million once and you lose it, you can do it again. It's real. It's a reality.
Rolf, how about you?
Well, as VTech, we have a truckload of lawyers to protect our own products, which VTech's manufacturing does, the phones and the electronic learning products. I would like to answer that question with, what some clients of mine made as a mistake in the past and as a patent agent. I can say they fell sometimes into the trap looking up Google, and when you look up how to file a patent or I would like to file a patent or something like that, you see on the right-hand side where all the paid ads are, file a patent, $99. File for a patent, $99. That is not a patent. There are certain patent categories. One is the design patent, the other one is a provisional patent application, but it's not a provisional patent, it's a provisional patent application. For $99, you can do it on your own. You don't need a lawyer or a patent attorney or a patent agent. You just write down what you think your invention is, and it will protect you for the filing date. So let's say today is July, 11th? If you've send it in to the USPTO in Alexandria, it will be there, and then when you file within 12 months your non-provisional patent application, you can refer to the filing date. So if someone in between today and your actual filing date of the non-provisional patent comes up with a filing, you know, it's yours, not the other party's patent application, which will be granted. The other one is they didn't do prior art search. Today, with Google and other search engines, you can look up patents and you can look up patent applications, because after 18 months, the USPTO need to publish your patent application, whether they have reviewed it or not, but the application will be made public. That's part of the deal with the USPTO and patent applications. So you can look up patent applications, or you can look up existing patents, and then you can work your claim or your invention around those patents. And when you have something novel, even though the product exists, and what the famous patent attorneys, phrases they are using is, you cannot file for aspirin. But if you grind aspirin into fine powder and it becomes an explosive, that's novel, and then you can file a patent for aspirin as an explosive. It's a little makeup, but you get the drift. So the other thing is people have not organize themselves, because what you need for an application is spec, claim, and drawing. And the drawings have to be done, and the spec has to be written, it's a text, and the claims is a certain language. And you say here with, I claim my invention is this and that and that. That should be presented to a patent agent or patent attorney, and then they can work with you. And maybe you have a sample, maybe you have an engineering model, and then so on.
So there is a lot that you can do to prepare. You've just given us some tips. But before we open it up to Rolf, what did you do about all that counterfeit mics that you found on the I want to hear the end of this story, don't we?
There is no end yet. It's work in progress, as we call it. I send it to the what was the name of the gentleman who came as a luncheon speaker?
Alex?
The guy who lived in, he's a Chinese, American Chinese. Very, very pleasant guy. That's car great. Collector has, what, how many, 20 antique cars or something like that in his garage?
Something like that.
And he's well familiar, and I sent it to them and also to Susan. And they replied and gave me an email address of the institution, which would be a part of the Homeland Security, the enforcement. They cannot go after, the USPTO will not go after infringements, patent infringements. A lawyer has to say, here is the patent infringement, and then you pull the other party into court. So the patent office is not an enforcement agency, so to speak, but other people, if this product would be shipped and U.S. Customs would see the address, the products probably would be confiscated. So that could be one legal action. The other one could be just on order from these people, you know, and because you, it's like a fake Rolex. If you bring it in, if Customs sees that watch, they will confiscate it. Well, the Chinese government could do it. I'm guessing here a little bit because China is very, very active and proactive when it comes now to patent. They try to really clean up the act and make fake stuff illegal and help people to file patents in China, American companies especially, and European companies. But there is no way to take down a China website unless you, some people which have been in the press 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, right? there has been some success with some NAM members have had success with their materials, and they've written about it extensively. But it does require that legal intervention. Before we open up to questions, please thank our panel. They are so smart, so bright. They were so much fun to be with. The USPTO always feeds us. We have a tradition of pizza and Georgetown-based cupcakes that they bring to us, so we like that. Are you all going to come back,
absolutely.
Alexandria?
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, it's a good endorsement, and I hope that we would keep your eye out for it. It'll be sometime in the spring after Frankfurt and other things that, you know, that occur before we hit the graduation season in early June. We try to do it about early May. So,
Can you make it 2 days?
We should make it 2 days. Would you like it 2 days?
Mm-hmm. I'd love it if it was a week.
All right, we will. We'll look at maybe doing specialty tracks. You know that we could have you know, some specialty tracks that they could expand on. I mean, they are giving us really a tremendous service. They come to the NAMM show. We hosted roundtables at the NAMM show. We'll do those again with them, specialty topic roundtables. And then they host the IP Academy. So it's been really great. We're going to do, anyone have any questions for the panel? Oh, I love the questions.
Oh, yeah.
And then Eric, you're going to be able to, by the way, we are recording this session. We're going to edit it down a little bit. Please state your name and your company, and then we're going to post this session on the web too. Please.
Sure. My name is Jim Colella. John and I work together at Pro Stage Gear. First, at the beginning of the presentation, I heard a very specific disclaimer from the Federal Trade Commission. Sort of, it was really around pricing and collusion and those sorts of things. It was a great statement from NAMM that this is what we're about and this is what we're not about. What role should NAMM play in the protection or the facilitation of issues related to trademark or patent or counterfeiting? And I'd like to give you a hypothetical situation that you might inform your answer, and I'm asking this open to the panel.
Are you speaking relative to the trade show itself?
Yes. So let's say that my company, not this company, but a company, has a very defensible patent. It's one thing to have copyright infringement or even just outright counterfeiting overseas. But it's another thing to find the nuance that makes the product, the very thing that is defensible within the patent, and then to exploit that feature. And then, let's say hypothetically, another manufacturer had been pushing the envelope overseas on a given product. And let's say that that given manufacturer dared bring it to the NAMM show, either in LA or here, and then began to represent that product as their own intellectual property. What role should NAMM take, if any, in mitigating that or vetting complaints like that? I'm curious,
yeah,
because these things exist, and certain vendors may or may not be more notorious in doing this than others.
There is a process, and I want to be careful that I don't speak outside of my realm of real knowledge about this. Though I there is a process with the trade show department and the trade show sales, and when you sign a contract, there is embedded language within the contract relative to intellectual property. I haven't seen that language for a while, but I know that that language is there. I do know that at every show, there are trademark disputes at every show. And NAM cannot arbitrate those disputes, but those disputes can occur, and we will take the direction of the enforcements that occur at the NAM show. And they have occurred. I think they have occurred at every NAM show, quietly. And I think that in my, so I think that that, you know, NAM is not the enforcer, but NAM has to abide by a policy that's inherent in its contracts. And then if on that trade show floor there is enforceable actions, then in the same way the lawyer of one firm has to come forward, get papers against another exhibitor. If there's a legal action occurring at the NAM show, NAM, that's a legal action, then NAM would have to abide by that action. I have to say that we are accelerating this debate inside NAM, because we are really concerned about our NAM members and their intellectual property assets, and that we know that there's a porousness, you know, that exists. So I think we will always go back and look at our policies, and then and again, I hope that answers your questions. Okay, other questions? Very good, thoughtful question. Please.
My name is Giles Davis. I'm an attorney with the firm of Beanstock and Michael. We represent a lot of the musical instrument companies at the show. I kind of have more comments than just questions. A couple things I want to make sure that was clarified. One has to do with customs. U.S. Customs will only stop products based on trademark. They will not block the entry of goods for copyright or patents. So if you're going to make a claim with the customs office to stop a product from coming, it has to be based on trademark rights. The one thing that kind of wasn't discussed in the panel that I think is really important is that once you have a trademark, your duty really isn't done. That a trademark owner has an affirmative duty to police their mark. So if people are using marks that are identical or substantially similar, it's up to you to put a stop to it. And if you don't, and you let that continue, then eventually you can lose your trademark rights even though you have a registration. So it's important that once you have obtained a trademark registration, and even if you haven't and you're still working on what's called common law rights, that you still need to make sure that you're sending out cease and desist letters to anybody that is improperly using your trademarks. And finally, this is the bad news kind of thing, is that especially when you're talking about patents, is particularly with litigation, is that to enforce patents is very expensive. So that's another thing that you kind of need to be prepared for. And if you need to take trademark infringement to litigation, you're talking about federal litigation. Both of those actions need to be brought in federal court, and it's not inexpensive. So it's kind of something they should have in the back of your head that, yes, I have this patent, I have this trademark or trademarks, but if you actually need to enforce it, that, again, the USPTO isn't going to handle that. You're going to have to bring an action. You're going to have to get a lawyer. You're going to have to bring an action in federal court, and it's not going to be inexpensive. So it's something that you should have in the back of your mind and be prepared that if it comes down to it, that that's going to be your course of action.
Thank you for that advice, and thank you for being here. Your work in the industry is heralded and precedes you, so thank you for sharing that. Thank you. Thank you very much for being here. And I'm sure you could be happy to network with folks and answer any questions. Great. Wonderful.
My name is John Miller. I'm a patent attorney, so I'm just going to follow up on the other side of things. Also a musician, and I love being here. But I think I came in a little late, so you may have touched on this, but I think an important thing that we need to talk about is the new law that came into effect this year. And the big change that that happened is the United States transitioned from a first-to-invent system to a first-to-file. So now it's really a race to the patent office. If you have an idea and you're working in your lab and you're taking notes and everything, Whereas before, that would protect you in a sense. Even if you filed after somebody else, they would go back and look at those lab notes and try and figure out who invented it first. That's going to be gone. That is gone now. For anything that we file now, it's a race to the patent office. So it's even more imperative you don't sit on your idea, sit in your room working on it. Get something on file with the patent office. And the other thing I wanted to quickly talk about was, you know, what I find with my clients is it's all about budget. You know, what can you afford? And of course, if you could file an international application, a PCT application, and file throughout the world, you'd get really comprehensive coverage, but nobody, you know, not many people can afford that. So what I try to do with my clients is to file the provisional application. The provisional application, though, where it could be just notes on a napkin, a very, very minimal disclosure. And that does give you a year to file your non-provisional application. That date will only protect you to the extent it's disclosed in that provisional application. So if that provisional application is very scant in details, and then through the year when you're writing your utility, your non-provisional application, you start to fill in the blanks and stuff, all those stuff that you filled in the blanks, that's not protected. That's not going to get the benefit of the earlier date. And so I try to write robust provisional applications. I write them as if I'm filing the actual application. You save money on the government filing fees. Basically, it's money you might have to invest down the road when you're writing your regular application, your non-provisional. You're just investing it up front. And what that does, it really is a place, it's a line holder in the sand, a placeholder in the sand. You can take that provisional and then from that, a year later, file your PCT application. You can file the U.S. non-provisional. It just gives you options. But I just would suggest, if you are going that route, to really write a robust provisional application to really protect yourself.
And I think these two comments are so grateful for really reinforce the fact that anything we do here will not replace legal advice. You know, I mean, what we're saying is that we are an information format, but if you want to do this, you've got to go to the granular. You've got to go, the responsibility for this is your relationship in a legal, from your legal advice. Ralph wanted to add something to that.
I would like to add to the gentleman's statement. With the provisional application, I always recommend to even put in claims, although don't have to put in a claim. Put in claims because you cannot add new matter like a year later when you file, or within a year. A year would be too late. You have to file within a year, because if you file and during that the provisional application, and then you think, well, maybe I can add something, if you add new matter, which is new stuff compared to what you have filed, you cannot do it. That will be thrown out. So putting in a few claims, like 1, 2, 3, 4 claims, and a drawing, and maybe whatever is supportive in terms of specification. Remember, spec, claim, drawing. That would be helpful, because it will not be looked at. The examiner will put it on a file and wait until you file the non-provisional.
That's right. I mean, if I could just... If you add new matter between your non-provisional or between your provisional application and your non-provisional, you can do that. You can add new matter in your non-provisional application when you actually the one that counts, but it won't get the benefit of that earlier date. That's the difference. Right.
And we want to move on to the final question. Okay.
Sure. There,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
And great information. And yes, if you're going to do this, that's the kind of support you really need. We want to make sure you get over to Insights in Time. Is there a final question? That anyone is just dying? Okay,
yes,
please.
My name is Brian Ostosh, and my question is in regards to trademarks. I invented a name for my company and Googled it, and it didn't exist in Google. It was denied by the trademark office because the first four letters are B-O-S-S, and Roland, like Greece, is trademark the word boss. They denied it at trademark office. My word didn't exist. So what do I do about something like that? This word doesn't exist, but yet they have a common word that they've trademarked and locked up, boss.
I, the word market.
Yeah.
Was it generic standard this, character, or was it?
I'm going to ask you guys to have a sidebar, all right? All right? One more question then here. Right, yes, one more. No.
Hi, we're Sandra and D.A. Counts. Our daughters are Ashley and Alexia and Gentry. They were the house band for the Predators their first and second year of their season, and we traveled all over in the casino route because of that. But now we want to do a publishing company. And the other night on the news came up Kraft Foods suing Cracker Barrel restaurants. And we had a family discussion about that, and it triggered the thought when you said that about John Travolta. So we had a family discussion about, is this suit going to go anywhere? And so I'd like to hear what you guys have to say about it, because it could be just a lame attempt on Kraft's part to get us to look at their products on the market. But
I'm going to ask you to sidebar with the legal brains in the house. Okay, that's going to be a great conversation with that. Please stay tuned for an NAMIP Academy. This is a good taste of what we want it to be, a discussion, an active discussion, an education group. Again, never with the ability to replace the really good legal advice that you need to sustain and grow your business. But we want to make it a forum for best practices, mistakes to avoid, where to get the knowledge, and just to build. I think it's remarkable what I'm seeing on the trade show floor. The innovators, fabricators, and creators of music products industry materials is just remarkable. Have a great NAM show. Head over to Insights, free food and drink over in the Davidson Ballroom, and a great conversation with the industry of heritage people. Thank you so much for being here.
Good seeing you, John. Good seeing you. Thanks for the use of this.